Hello and welcome. It is exciting to be here, isn't it? It's more exciting than usual because it's going to be the Oscars like any second now. They are imminent.
And then they'll be over.
And then they'll be over and we can ignore them all over again. I'm Christy.
I'm Alonzo.
Yep, you're Christy and you're Alonzo.
Sure thing.
That's correct, and that's Matt.
Who are you?
Fine, I'm Ben.
Fine. See, so if only we had a host. If only we had a host, it would make everything better.
I know.
This is what happens. I did whose podcast? Colin Cowherd's podcast about Oscars that'll be up over the weekend.
I've done that podcast.
Have you?
Yeah.
I like Colin Cowherd. I don't know whether I'm supposed to, but I definitely do. And he went and talked about going hostless for the Oscars. And I was like, you and I, we hate this. We're hosts, literally. This is
you are?
They're stealing a gig.
Well, I was telling Alonzo, there is a theory that's out there that secretly Whoopi Goldberg is going to host. That, like, she's been gone. She's been sick from The View ever since the Oscars announced that there would be no host at all. And the theory is that she's been secretly rehearsing.
And she's an ABC employee.
That's true.
I think they're going to have a host, and then Thanos is going to snap, and halfway through, the host will disappear.
Or it'll turn out he was a Skrull all along.
Spoiler. Okay, so let's talk about the Oscars. Oscars are on Sunday. We're going to do a few quick little predictions, and then we've got a couple of film reviews, and, of course, the latest True Detective, as always. But as Ben was saying before we began this, the Oscar odds for Best Picture have tightened.
Yeah, so not a lot, but it's worth mentioning that there's really only two movies with any chance to win, Roma and Green Book, according to the odds makers. Now, obviously, they could be wrong, but if The Favorite won, or Bohemian Rhapsody, or Black Panther, that would be, or Star is Born, would have a serious payoff. That would be a big upset. I mean, the Black Panther is a 28-1, Bohemian Rhapsody 25-1, Favorite 20-1. But Green Book has moved from like 5-1 not that long ago to about a little under 4-1. And Roma has gone from 1-3 to about 1-2. Okay. Now, what causes those moves? I don't know.
I'll tell you. I have a theory.
Okay.
So, and this lines up with, Mark Thompson sends me a note this morning like, hey, I just saw Roma. Why is it in the running for Best Picture? Because he's like, I'm not seeing it.
Are Mark Thompson?
Yeah.
There's like 14.
No, you're Mark Thompson.
My Mark Thompson.
Yeah, okay. No, Mark Thompson, my neighbor. Right. And that's why I'm bringing this up to you. So I tell him, well, two things. A, it's over
it's
to
a
side.
Great movie and you're a Philistine.
Well, all right. Like, let's leave out the idea that it's a good movie.
A funny Philistine who's great to hang out with.
No, love
makes
you, Mark,
party
but
better.
Come on.
Right. So I tell him, like, well, it's autobiographical for the filmmaker, and that resonates with the Academy. And Netflix has had a crazy campaign for that movie. They are spending money like water for that movie, and I think that's part of why it was the front runner for a while. Now, I think what's hurt it in the voting was the reports a couple weeks ago, or no, just this last week or so, that Roma is a Best Picture nominee that has done zero at the box office. Because it was only really kind of screened. It's hardly made any money. And I suspect there's a few people like, wait a minute.
Well, actually, what that means is it is zero reported at the box office.
Sure.
Because it did have theatrical runs in a lot of cities, not even just the token New York, L.A. Oscar runs. It opened in El Paso, Texas. It opened in a lot of places where there are Mexican audiences. But Netflix doesn't care about box office. It's not part of their model, so they haven't reported it. And, you know, which, if anything, is just a reminder that every time you see the box office reports, those aren't, like, independently verified or audited. That's just what the studio told somebody.
Oh, right. Totally.
So I assume if Roma wins, Alonzo, you will not that will not cause you to roll your eyes, but almost every other movie winning will.
No, I mean, like if The Favorite or A Star Is Born, yeah, no. If Green Book wins, yes, major eye rolling. And so I wish I could remember who now. One critic on Twitter said we may be looking at a year in which Green Book wins Best Picture and Spike Lee wins Best Director.
Wow,
and that is certainly a possibility.
And you cannot even imagine like two other films at the most opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of this depiction of race relations.
I think it's
Roma and Green Book could not be more opposite.
I feel bad because of the way this conversation has gone for Green Book, because if it were just a movie that came out and wasn't nominated for an Oscar, it'd be a lot easier to be like, oh, man, those performances are really good. And that was a sort of a feel-good movie that should not be representative of how we deal with race today. And nor particularly should it have been how we dealt with race in 1989. But at least that was closer.
Sure.
So we should talk about what other nominees there are, because there are 8 nominees for Best Picture. Let's run through them really, really fast. You've got Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favorite, Black Panther, Black Klansman, Green Book, Vice, A Star is Born, and Roma.
Did we really have to have two black movies? Come on.
All of them. So I think Roma's going to win. I think Roma's going to win, and I think Alfonso Cuarón's going to win because it's a masterpiece, and maybe I'm just being optimistic.
I hope Roma's going to win. I fear Green Book is going to win, and I think Spike Lee is going to win because it's his The Departed.
Well, I will tell you that regarding,
that'd be cool.
Again...
Which I'm okay with. I didn't love Black Klansman, but I got no problem with Spike Lee having an Oscar.
No, of course Spike Lee should have an Oscar. The Alfonso Cuarón, you have to bet $2,500 to win $100.
Okay.
So he get the $2,500 back?
He is an overwhelming favorite. So Spike Lee being the only other possibility at 10-1. More or less is in the running, I suppose. But 1-25 favorites, like Mike Tyson was not a 1-25 favorite over Buster Douglas. That is almost too prohibitive to imagine that bet not coming through.
Well, if Cuarón wins, that will be 4 Mexican filmmakers in 5 years.
5 and 6, I think. I think it already is.
Oh, it already is.
Because Cuarón won for Gravity. Cuarón won for Gravity. Del Toro won for Shape of Water. And Iñárritu won for Birdman.
And for The Revenant.
Yeah.
Oh.
Remember? Yeah. He's the second filmmaker to win back-to-back director Oscars, as though...
Who's the first?
Mankey something.
See, that's why we need to build a wall.
Of that troika of directors that Iñárritu gets that honor. Bleh. Anyway, that's me.
Anyway, so what do you guys think is going to win Best Picture? Then, like, make your pick now. I'm going out and I'm saying Roma, but I would love it if the favorite won.
Yeah, I think Roma will win. I pray that Roma wins because if we're to believe the odds, then the second choice is Green Book, and that's a catastrophe.
Yeah, I was disappointed it wasn't about tomatoes. But I got to go with Roma.
All your puns are really bad today.
Yeah,
did you think of them when you were stuck in traffic on the 405?
The first two jokes were not puns.
They're all bad.
And I didn't take the 405.
It's all bad.
Whatever.
Alonzo, is your pick? Is Roma going to win?
I hope it's Roma. Yes.
Okay. Let's move on. So then, do we also?
Good. I have more bad jokes.
Okay. Great. I think Roma wins and Cuarón wins, but it sounds like there's also the possibility of Spike Lee in the equation here. What do you guys think?
Well, as I just said, 1-25 doesn't lose.
Okay, so you think Cuarón wins, Matt?
I think Spike Lee's got a shot.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the same. I mean, yeah, the math is hard to argue, but I can see there. I can see there's two things. One, the fact that Spike Lee's never even been nominated for Best Director up until now, and I think it becomes a body of work award. And I think it's a way that people can then feel better about also voting for Green Book for Best Picture.
Yeah,
yes, that's right. I think that they could get away with that. And again, you know, as someone who's friends with so many octogenarian Academy voters, I will just repeat that there is the Roma is dealing with the resentment of the fact that it was not a theatrical release.
Yeah, Netflix people are still afraid.
It's not they think, hey man, it's not a movie. I got it. It might be good, but that's not what a movie is. And Green Book makes them feel good about their liberalism in a changing world where sometimes they feel like, hey, when did all of a sudden when did I become the bad guy? And many of these are incredibly good people, but the change is hard for people, and this has been an abrupt change. So the enthusiasm with which some of those people who I've talked to treat Green, oh my God, I loved it, so moving, so wonderful. And as we know, the Academy is average age 63 years old or what?
Well, here's an anecdote for you. Okay, so this last weekend we taped our KPCC Oscar show, which we do live in front of a packed audience at the theater at the Ace Hotel downtown. Gorgeous historic theater, sells out every year. So these are public radio listeners, probably about, a lot the same age as Academy voters.
Right, yeah.
There was so much enthusiasm in that room for Green Book.
Yeah, I don't think it should be shocking. It makes them feel good, and in a changing world that feels unstable, Green Book is super familiar to them.
It's entertaining. I mean, those guys are both pros. Like, they have, it's problematic, it is, but those guys are lovely together. They have nice chemistry,
That's why,
whatever.
That's what makes me feel bad about that I so desperately desperately don't want it to win because there's, you know, the performances are good and Octavia Spencer is an executive producer and it's like, it's fine. It's just crazy.
It's just despicable.
right. The problem is it's despicable. It's lovely, but it's despicable.
All right. So let's move on then to what we're talking about.
And just real quick, the idea that a black and white Spanish language film wins Best Picture is in itself fairly revolutionary given how reactionary the Academy tends to be. So that's a lot to hope for.
Especially in a year following the Best Picture winner being also from a Mexican director about fish sex, right? It's a horror movie. It's a horror fantasy, right. Shape of Water. So anyway, let's move on since we're talking about performances. Let's talk about Best Actor. I'm guessing Rami Malek is your far and away favorite.
Yeah, but not like Cuaron. He's one, but a big. You got to bet 700 to win 100 on Rami Malek. Christian Bale's 4-1, so it would be at most a two-person race, but Rami Malek a prohibitive favorite.
Right.
So
Christian Bale is the runner-up on that?
Yeah. I would think maybe Bradley Cooper. So your nominees are Bradley Cooper, Willem Dafoe, Rami Malek, Viggo Mortensen, Christian Bale.
But Cooper's 25-1, Mortensen's 33-1, Bale's 4-1.
I'd love to see Bradley Cooper win. I think he gets underestimated for what all he has to do in that performance, emotionally, physically, musically. It's a huge departure for him, character-wise, and he also had to direct himself while he was doing it. So, I mean, it's not going to happen, but it'd be really cool to see a Bradley Cooper.
No, I agree. He's doing a lot of stuff. And you know, he's also singing for himself. Like, right. Rami Malek, you know, he lip syncs gloriously. And
through prosthetic teeth.
The performance sequences are great, but then when he has to actually start talking, I think it's a terrible performance. And I'm shocked at how many people have drunk the Kool-Aid of like, oh, it's so brilliant.
Well, that's the script. That's them walking out feeling good after Live Aid.
But it's also a terrible performance.
So Rami Malek is going to win, do we all think?
Yeah, I think he's going to win. I would love it if Christian Bale won, but I think Malek wins.
Okay, Best Actress is also extremely obvious, it seems. What are the odds on Glenn Close?
Yesterday she was 1-10. I'm just taking 1-8 now, so it shrank a little bit. Olivia Colman, basically 4.5-1. Okay. So you got about 800 to win 100 on Glenn Close, and like I said, Olivia Colman at 9-2, and then the others would be big reaches. Melissa McCarthy, the biggest. At 66-1.
It's your long shot.
The biggest long shot. That's the word I was unable to come up with. Lady Gaga at 20-1.
Lady Gaga, Melissa McCarthy, Olivia Colman, Yalitza Aparicio, and Glenn Close.
Yeah, Aparicio's 40-1.
And the thing is, like, you know, who can complain about Glenn Close finally winning an Oscar? This is what, her 7th nomination. She's got incredible longevity and versatility.
And the first time she is not competing with Meryl Streep.
There you go. It's her year. Mamma Mia, here we go again. Didn't get nominated.
I don't know if it's 18 or 19, but Meryl Streep has lost 19 times. She's such a loser.
Total loser. Sad.
It's so sad. Embarrassing, really.
I kind of put this in the, like, I wouldn't give Spike Lee an Oscar for Black Klansman necessarily, but I don't mind if he gets one for all the other ones. Ditto Glenn Close and The Wife.
It would be good if Spike Lee won 30 years after Do the Right Thing should have.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Okay, Matt?
No. Yeah, I think it's going to be Glenn Close.
Okay. Let's do supporting actor. Your nominees are Adam Driver, Mahershala Ali, Sam Rockwell, Sam Elliott, and Richard E. Grant. I think Richard E. Grant wins.
Now, Mahershala Ali is a favorite like Cuaron. Yeah, so the good news is that maybe that, like, that satisfies
the
Green Book, because obviously there's nothing wrong with Mahershala Ali winning conceptually. He's one of the finest actors working.
Sure.
He's 1-20, so 2,000 to win 100. Richard E. Grant is the second choice at 9-1. Sam Elliott, 16-1. Rockwell, who I thought was so unbelievably great, 50-1. And Adam Driver, 33-1.
So I think Richard E. Grant will win, and here's why. Because he has been totally freaking delightful all throughout award season. And all you ever see in any article, any anecdote is like, he's having the best time. And so he's like,
he's not jaded in the slightest.
No, he's not. And I guess, you know, he's been a long time character actor. I guess he figures, like, this is my shot. I'm going to have a ball with it. And I think that the genuine effusiveness of that could be really persuasive.
Also, Mahershala Ali just won one.
He did.
Yeah, but let's not forget, Christoph Waltz won two of these in pretty close succession for the same director.
I think it's really good news for Roma that Mahershala Ali is such an overwhelming favorite to win Best Supporting Actor. Again, as Alonzo said, to satisfy the Green Book itch.
Okay,
I was surprised that Rockwell got it.
I think Mahershala, but I could see Richard E. Grant sort of sneaking up on it, and if it were me, I'd give it to Sam Elliott again for a career of not getting awards from the people.
Okay, Ben, you say Mahershala.
Yeah.
Matt, you say Mahershala.
Yeah, I mean, I'm picking the chalk.
Yeah, I think Mahershala. No, you know what? Actually, I'm going to go with Richard E. Grant.
Let's
I also want to say I'm somewhat surprised that Sam Rockwell got nominated because he's not far off of what he was doing in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Totally.
And he just won.
Yeah.
He won last year, which, of course, we just said happens right. sometimes. Yeah. Okay.
Right, but getting a nomination after mm-hmm. you win makes a great deal of sense, mm-hmm. in fact, because you're sort of on
like,
the
oh, radar. Yeah. I remember that guy.
Okay, so I guess half of us are saying Richard E. Grant. Half of us are saying Mahershala Ali. Supporting actress, let's move on to that. We got Emma Stone for The Favorite and Rachel Weisz for The Favorite. Regina King, Marina de Tavira, and Amy Adams. I think Regina King, and that seems to be The Favorite, yes?
Yeah, but this she is The Favorite. You got about 300 to win 100. She's not as prohibitive a favorite as some of the others. But this is the only race where three people have reasonable odds. Rachel Weisz is 6-1, Amy Adams 4-1, and the Regina King, as I said, 1-3, and then Emma Stone and Marina Del. How do we say her name?
De Tavira.
She's at 25-1.
Okay, so who do you guys pick?
I'm going to go out on a limb on this one. I think Marina de Tavira. I think that
move.
This is, I think for people who would have voted for Ulysses Aparicio, but they feel like they owe it to Glenn Close, this is a way to sort of honor the acting in that movie. And I don't know. There's just something about it where I could see it. And I could be totally wrong on this. I'm the worst Oscar prognosticator on earth. Do not use me to do your Oscar pool. But I don't know. I have a hunch if there's going to be a surprise, that might
be
it.
Then, okay. I mean, then if you
that's
are,
persuasive.
It's, I mean, 25-1, then if you, you know, then it's, that's worth, I mean, it's worth $20. You win $500. Right?
So, hook me up with your bookie.
I was going to say, so head on out to Vegas now before the traffic. Matt, who's your pick?
I think Rachel Weisz is going to sneak in there.
Interesting. Okay, so why? Which is great, of course.
She's a previous winner.
She's great. She's a previous winner. She also had the other great Disobedience this year.
Oh, yeah. So good.
And so
was that
think,
this year?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
It's early.
I think she sneaks in.
Okay.
I think Regina King's going to win. I'll stick with the favorite here, and I think there's a you know grounds. She's one of the actresses everybody likes. Regina King. It's impossible.
Yeah, and she swept the critics.
Yeah, and it's impossible not to meet her and engage with her and not like her. And she's,
and did she win the SAG Award?
Yes, I think she's won. I think she's won every single thing you can win leading up to this. I mean, the wig scene alone.
Did she win the SAG Award?
Should win it for her. You don't think so?
I don't. I was there.
Did she win the SAG Award for that or the TV?
Oh, for 7 seconds?
I don't remember. Yeah. Alonzo's going to look it up. You guys probably all know this already, and you're like, come on, people. Know your stuff. But we're going to look it up while we're talking. And then we'll move on to, we'll do a couple of screenplay categories and some other random grab bag categories. Who can look at their phone the fastest? Ben and Alonzo. All right. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
No, I'm kidding. She was not nominated.
Oh, that's weird.
That's why, because I didn't see her. The Emily Blunt one.
Oh, that's right. From Mary Poppins.
Right.
No, she went for Quiet Place.
That's right,
For supporting, yeah.
That's right.
She was nominated for Mary Poppins.
That's right.
Okay, well, then that throws a fork into all this, because usually the actors branch is the largest one of the Academy, right?
Yeah, yes. By far. Okay. Yeah. But that said, the winner is not nominated, so I think it throws a fork in it and then it removes the fork.
Could be.
Yeah. it's interesting, and who knows? I mean, Margot Robbie was also nominated, and then Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz and Amy Adams.
Interesting. All right. So we are split on that. So original screenplay, your nominees are First Reformed, Green Book, Vice, The Favorite, and Roma. I would love to see First Reformed win because it is so bold and it should be in many, many categories, not just this one. Ethan Hawke should be in Best Actor. So I would love to see First Reformed win. But if The Favorite won too, that'd be awesome.
I don't know. I'm just totally curious how they set these odds. I mean, they can only set them from previous award shows on this. I mean, The Favorite is 1-2, but 200 to win 100, and then Green Book is 2-1, Roma 7-1, First Reform 14-1, Vice 40-1. So The Favorite is the
favorite. But the movie that won an original screenplay at the Writers Guild Awards is not even nominated here, and that is Bo Burnham for Eighth Grade.
Yeah, well,
which should be in here.
I'd love a Betty Davis like write-in campaign. Eighth Grade get Best Picture. I don't think that's going to happen. So, not even nominated, but it won. It won twice at. It won two big awards.
It won first film at the DGA.
First director of the DGA.
And it won your heart.
It did. So what are we saying then? The favorite's going to win an original screenplay, possibly? What do you guys think?
I'm going to go with the here. I'll be the first time I deviate. It's a slight deviation, but I'll take Green Book again. That there's a way to,
You have to give an award to the guy who retweeted the thing about Muslims and 9/11. And
Right. You're right. I forgot.
Nick Vallelonga's a Trumper.
I'm taking it out. I mean, you know, my limb going out, and I'll say First Reformed because that would be so enormously satisfying.
That's a should win and another case of a career award for somebody who's never been nominated, Paul Schrader.
Right. And I don't know whether they like him. I know that the people who I know. Yeah. Like him and would love to see it.
I'm thinking The Favorite just because I suspect there's something about period pieces that makes people think that something is automatically more serious. I don't know.
Even though it's so like delightfully anachronistic and mean and weird.
Yes.
That'd be cool. I'd love to see The Favorite win.
Yeah, I think The Favorite's going to take it.
Okay, cool. Let's then do adapted screenplay, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Black Klansman, Can You Ever Forgive Me, A Star is Born, and Beale Street.
Well, Can You Ever Forgive Me won the Writers Guild Award, which is not necessarily a bellwether. What are the odds?
It's tight. Black Klansman, a solid favorite. Again, like Regina King, 1-3. So you bet 300 to win 100. And then if Beale Street Could Talk is 5-1, but the second favorite is actually Can You Ever Forgive Me at 3-1. And then Star is Born in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, long shots.
I think Can You Ever Forgive Me wins because that screenplay is. It's a writer writing about writers pretending to be other writers. I think that's going to appeal to the folks who are voting for this. And it's so sharp and witty and mean, but there's also great sensitivity to it. So I think that is going to be your winner.
See, I think that's why it got nominated, because the writer's branch comes up with the nominations, but everybody votes on the award.
Do they? The whole membership?
Yep,
whole
membership.
Gwyneth Paltrow, who doesn't know what The Favorite is.
Isn't that funny?
So I think that Black Klansman's going to get it.
Okay.
I think Black Klansman's going to win, too.
And if I'm not mistaken, all the Black Klansman writers are white?
Well, Spike Lee is listed.
Is he co-credited? Okay.
He's been in blackface all these years.
Oh, my God. Enough. You've got to stop. No, Spike Lee is not listed. Oh, yeah, he is. He's one of the three screenwriters here. Anyway, so there you go. So we are split on that. Any other categories that you guys have interest in, you're pulling for? I personally would love to see Ruth E. Carter win costume design for Black Panther. That'd be really cool.
I think Gaga wins for song.
That's easy.
Yeah, that's a given. I would love to see First Man get production design because I think that movie really uses the sets in a way to sort of express the terror and the flimsiness of that. Like, I've never seen, again, you know, like in all the movies that we've had about like the moonshots and stuff, I've never had that feeling, not just of claustrophobia, but of like, are these rivets even going to hold?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the
like on a sub movie when they're too low and the things start shooting out. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, a lot of that is sound design and other things, but I think the production design is really important.
I keep getting, when I do these interviews, I always forget to say when they say, because my answer is always Eighth Grade, you know, if they're a movie that got left out. But First Man, obviously, is better than many of the nominees.
Yeah, I saw Apollo 11 yesterday. I was like, oh, I got to see First Man again.
I can't wait for you guys to see Apollo 11. We got to talk about it.
Yeah, it's great.
I loved Apollo 10. That was for Matt. Best documentary is very competitive.
Yes.
Between Free Solo, which is 8 to 11, so just above. We got about 1,100 to win 800 or 110 to win 80, and RBG, which is even money. So it's really a two horse race there.
Yeah, the one that was left out was
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, Mr. Rogers.
Well, Sandy Tan got Shirkers. Ripped off for Shirkers, and then, boy, am I blanking on his name, got ripped off twice, not only for Won't You Be My Neighbor, but also for They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
Oh, right.
So your documentary nominees are Of Fathers and Sons, Hale County, This Morning, This Evening, Minding the Gap, RBG, and Free Solo.
Minding the Gap's 14-1, some shot, but Hale County and Of Fathers and Sons are 33-1 and 50-1. You know, look, Free Solo obviously could win because it has won, but RBG, I just think that this is a group that you know.
Morgan Neville.
And again, her presence in the right. news and her coming back and getting a vote right. in just before
it's
the
them giving her an Oscar.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, of course it's giving her an Oscar. Yeah. No question.
I still can't watch Free Solo. I just can't.
It's so, I've seen it so many times. I've done so many Q&As with Alex Honnold. I've seen it so many times. It's a tremendous technical achievement, and it makes you feel so good
and
coming out of
Hale
it.
Hale County is gorgeous, but I was shocked that it was even nominated because it's so not what they usually go for. It's very experimental and not very sort of narratively driven.
Right. I want to say also real fast, foreign language. I'd love to see Cold War win because it's incredible and just efficient and elegant and moving, and Joanna Kulig is a star, and it shot right. so beautifully. And it won't win cinematography, and it won't win director for Pavel Pawlikowski. So foreign language is a good place, I suspect, sure. for Cold War to win.
But I'm curious, how...
Does Roma become the runner-up by getting foreign and not picture?
If Roma wins, and then does Roma allow people to vote for it for... some people are going to not vote for Roma... They're going to know it's good. They're not going to vote for it for Best Picture and then feel very comfortable voting for it for Best Foreign Language Film. But if it wins Best Picture, how on earth can it not win Best Foreign Language
right.
Film?
It could win both.
Because other people in other countries make movies. That's how.
Lafka gets that question every time we give Best Picture to a foreign film and then something else gets Best Foreign Film.
So, because people's brains work differently in that. So it would be great if Cold War won.
Any categories for you, Matt, that you're particularly interested in that you hope something wins?
No, I think we covered them all.
All right.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, I take it, the far and away favorite.
Spider-Verse will win and should win.
That'll be great to see.
Animated feature, Spider-Man is a gargantuan favorite, 2,000 to win 100,
I've also seen all 15 of the shorts, if anybody wants to talk about the shorts with me.
I heard this year was a real downer of a collection.
So four of the five of the live-action shorts are like boys in trouble movies, like boys getting stuck in quicksand or boys witnessing a horrific racial attack or boys being trapped by themselves on the beach and their mom can't reach them, and it's very stressful. I'll just say that. So if anyone wants to ever talk about the shorts with me, I've seen them all. Hooray. Cool. Where will you guys watch the Oscars on Sunday night? Where will you guys be?
I'm going to be in Atlanta. I'm going this weekend for the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. I'm doing the jury there. So I am going to be watching them for the first time in a long time with my best friend from college, Kurt Holman, who is the co-host of the Comics Canon podcast.
There you go. Ben?
I don't watch the Oscars. I'll be watching the Knicks and the Suns. I'll be home. I'll watch the Oscars at home.
Okay.
I'll be at home.
Okay. Same.
What about you?
I'm curious, and I'm super interested in production, so I'm very interested. I had not heard that Whoopi Goldberg rumor. I love it.
It's just a theory.
Yeah, it's a fun theory. I'm just curious how it will work without a host. I mean, it's I love the idea that maybe they'll back off on the skits. That's good, but a host sort of, again, a good host makes things work a lot more smoothly. And
cohesively.
And I don't think in this era where, it's so easy for us to see what stars are doing and we're exposed to stars all the time, and, I don't know that we're like, ooh, Daniel Craig,
That's how I react when I see Daniel Craig.
Who would be the worst possible host? Somebody Hollywood.
Stephen Miller.
Steve Bannon.
That's it.
Film producer Steve Bannon.
Also, we should mention really fast because...
you guys aren't going to answer that.
Alonzo did. I think that was...
I was going to say Harvey Weinstein.
Cosby.
Within 2 hours of posting the podcast last week, you guys, the Academy changed its mind.
Oh, yeah.
And decided that it was indeed going to air live those
all
four 24. Categories that they were going to show during commercial break. So our podcast was a wee bit obsolete soon afterwards. So for the record, they will indeed show all 24 categories live for the 4.5 hour long Oscar broadcast that we all need.
I am very sympathetic to John Bailey and the people having to make, being pulled in 1,000 different directions by 1,000 different interests. In a world where television rating, Emmy's lowest rated ever, lowest 18 to 49 ever for the Grammys, lowest Super Bowl rate, number of people watching the Super Bowl ever or in recent memory. So, live television viewing isn't what it used to be. And there's an obvious desire to get this down to 3 hours. That may be impossible, and that may not save it. But I know that that's their instinct to try and get it down to 3 hours. And that's what... that's what motivated this. And they did it in agreement. It wasn't like some unilateral edict from a dictator. And then the rebellion against it was, you know, ridiculously harsh, considering it's just a television show where we give famous people awards.
I don't think it was ridiculously harsh. I think it was totally merited because it seemed to degrade.
The famous
degrade.
People awards weren't being removed.
So the reaction among the vitriol.
I see.
Reaction was, people care about the Oscars. That's why people watch the Oscars. They care about it. You're going to expect that response. So let me be specific.
Okay.
The vitriol was silly. Like, it's not worth getting that exercised. And you should just understand it's a television show. Right? It's not just the Oscars. It's a television show. When it becomes a television show, believe me, the number of people who are involved, the number of cooks in the kitchen on a television show.
But it's been a television show for 60 years.
Right. we talked about this last week. Like, part of the problem is there's so many other shows that are doing, the only game in town.
It's not as special as it used to be. But I think, one thing that no one ever talks about getting rid of, it's like when you watch the Grammys, they don't explain to you what jazz is.
Yeah.
So I don't know why we always have to devote these chunks of the Oscars to talk about like film history. It's like, yeah, those are fun clip packages and stuff, but ultimately it's like if you're already watching the Oscars. Mm-hmm.
They have a good presence online. They should release that stuff online. I would say that, and this is an unpopular opinion, and I know it, but if I were shortening it and a gun was to my head, I wouldn't have the songs, because that's not the songs. Frequently, as we know, they just go over the credits, right? I mean, if we have the songs, you could make an argument for best adapted screenplay, and here's a 3.5-minute scene from
but that's because, like, you being that it's a television show, and like ever said that it's a performance of a song here's, wasn't an entertaining aspect.
The ruthless thing I would do if I was managing that show, if I ran this out, the new popular category would be you'd split up Best Picture, Best Limited Release, and Best Wide Release, and set the bar for Wide Release at 2,000 theaters.
But some things platform, and they open in New York and L.A., then they go wide eventually.
But that's
a limited release. Okay. Like, if you're that,
that's interesting. That's a way to do it without sounding like a most popular movie.
Right. Best wide release, best limited release. And if you're going to four-wall your theater and two theaters to make the cutoff, then you're in limited release.
That's very interesting. I like that thought. But for the songs, the problem with the songs definitely is you can't have two of the five play.
No. So all or nothing.
I like the idea of all, none, and then the winner. They would never agree to
or
it.
A medley.
And then the winner
do
does.
Do a medley.
Sure. But the other awards that I would bump over to, like, the where the tech awards get given out is this at the separate night would be you wouldn't play the songs, you could give out song that night, but bump the short film awards.
Which is one of the ones they were trying to cut this past time.
I understand, but like,
I don't
bump
agree with
the
that
short
because
films. Like,
I think that for I think
they
that
still
for,
get them.
I think that for young people who are interested in movies and aspire to be filmmakers, those short categories are something that's more directly aspirational for the person at home. And I think a lot of times also it's where we get a first glimpse of somebody who's going to be a big thing later on. And so I'm all about nurturing those guys and giving them a spot.
It's not that they don't get nurtured. It's just that they're...
It's often a platform, too, for, like, up-and-coming talent.
I think you add a couple of awards, take it up to 26, make it a 4.5-hour show, put it on Turner Classic Movies.
Anyway.
We'll show it three times.
We will all be watching.
My tweet was Oscars on Netflix, only Bandersnatch.
All right. Thank you guys for your input. And we'll all be watching. We'll be curious to hear what your thoughts are on who wins and who doesn't, and who hosts or who doesn't.
And we're quite possibly wrong about everything, so never forget that.
And now we're going to move on and talk about really the only main big new movie release of the week, and that is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World.
So this finds the Vikings of Berk have made peace with the dragons, and they're hunting the hunters, and their island of Berk has become a haven for dragons to the point that there's probably too many dragons on their little tiny island. People are out still, other Vikings are out still hunting them. There's legends of a hidden world at the end of the world that Hiccup is thinking he's going to try and find some place to hide so that they don't have to hide from the dragon hunters anymore. And there also may be another, what is it, Night Fury? Another Night Fury out there.
Night Fury.
yeah. So, and then dragons and flying and hilarity ensues.
But really not hilarity at all. This is a very sad movie. This is a very heavy movie.
It is relatively heavy.
This is scary. This has serious emotional heft. This is about growing up. This is a movie about growing up and becoming your own person and about if you love somebody, set
letting
them free.
Go. Yeah.
So it's very emotional. It's beautiful. Roger Deakins, my great hero, once again is like the cinematography consultant here. So he did whatever he does,
right. But
in animated form. And if you've seen either of the previous How to Train Your Dragon movies, you know that like they're so beautifully, exquisitely detailed, and the colors are so lovely, and that is really true here, both in very delicate ways, like the pinky cotton candy sunsets, and also just there's a journey.
Or the cloud movement as they're flying through the clouds.
Yeah, and there's a journey they take to a whole other realm, and it's like some cool, like, underwater aquarium black light situation. Like,
right. The
colors are unbelievably bright shades of, like, cobalt blue and bright greens and pink. And there's so much attention to detail. It's always lovely to look at. And
I was a little disappointed they didn't show this to us in 3D, because the first How to Train Your Dragon was actually the first movie that I'd seen that I felt really made effective use of 3D.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially the first power dive that Hiccup and Toothless do into the water and then pull up at the last second. Mm-hmm. And as that happens in 3D, you're kind of like...
Yeah, there are clearly a bunch of images here that are intended to be seen
right.
in 3D
yeah.
that we did not see in 3D.
But yeah. I, the way these movies have handled the flying scenes and using 3D to really make that feel immersive has been really effective, and I think adds something to the movie. And I was, again, a little disappointed they didn't show it to us in the screening in 3D. But I think that this is it's a great movie. You catch up with characters that, you know, you are kind of invested in what's going on with them. And, you know, Hiccup learns to kind of stand on his own, and he learns who he is, that he doesn't need the dragon, that he's not just, you know, the weird inventor. Like, he actually has good ideas and he actually is a leader, and mm-hmm. he kind of steps up and finds some confidence there.
He has to be a grown up and live up to his father's legacy, his father, the king, and there's the pressure of that. There are a lot of opportunities for supporting characters to have a little fun. Kristen Wiig is hilarious as just this super annoying, fast talking, just narcissistic weirdo.
Right.
I mean, she's great in it. It's an incredible voice cast, but what I like about these movies is that it's not the kind of, like, look at me celebrity voice cast where it's like you're obviously listening to somebody with a famous voice. Like, the script is strong enough and they immerse themselves in it enough that it's not a massive distraction. So I forgot, like, oh yeah, that's Cate Blanchett. Like, I forgot
right.
about that until halfway through.
The first movie, I think you really get that, right? The first movie, you know it's Christmas Plass. You know that it's Jonah Hill. You know that it's, what's his name, who's not in this one?
Gerard Butler?
No, Silicon Valley.
Thomas
Middleditch.
T.J. Miller. T.J. Miller was not in this one as the voice of the twin brother. And there's some other voice actor trying to sound like him. But he and Kristen Wiig were the twins
oh, right.
in previous movies. But he's been left out.
It's a different... Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
But that had not even occurred to me as I was listening to it that there was an issue with that. It's a lot of fun. There is a lot of stressful stuff for kids. There are these dragons that, like, breathe acid fire.
Right.
And so they're, like, genetically enhanced acid-breathing dragons. And so they more than just set things ablaze when
they melt stuff.
Like, stuff just gets decimated. And there's a heightened level of menace with the major villain here, voiced by F. Murray Abraham, who I did not realize that's who that was.
Yeah, I kept wondering, like, who is that?
I'm like, is that Javier Bardem? He's doing kind of like a Spanish accent a little bit.
I felt like he was trying to do Ricardo Montalban.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, yeah, like he's trying to be Khan.
Yeah. No, no. And I couldn't place it for a long time. But again, a great example of like a great actor, and we don't know who it is. He's immersing himself in the role.
Dragons are a dish best served cold.
Yeah. Exactly. And you do have Gerard Butler doing that.
P.S. I have not seen this yet. I am dying to see it, but I can't review it because I know the director. So that's why I'm just sitting here quietly.
Yes. But you've seen the other two.
Yes.
You are a fan. Yes. Dean DuBois.
DuBois.
He says it right. It's not like in Louisiana, your last name could be like D-E-B-L-I-E-U-X, and everyone pronounces it W.
He's Canadian. He pronounces it correct.
Oh, okay. DuBois.
DeMonet.
DuBois. So, yeah, this is a lot of fun, and it is good. I brought Nick with me, and he loved it. He's 9. I would say, though, for much littler kids, it's kind of scary. It's kind of intense and very emotional. I will admit, I cried.
Yeah, I got a little choked up at the end.
Yeah. The end is sad.
The end is sad.
We're not spoiling anything.
But everybody dies.
Lest you guys think that we're... I know you guys are very concerned and very sensitive, and I appreciate that. I do, but we're not spoiling. We're trying really hard not to spoil.
But Thanos wins.
But it's also, yes. There's like a Thanos version of a dragon who like snaps his paw, whatever.
His wings. Snaps his wings and then half of everyone disappears.
No, but it's sad and it's happy sad. And the...
Bittersweet.
It is bittersweet. It's a good way to phrase it. So, yeah, I kind of dug it. And it's got amazing reviews. I'm saying 7.8. What's your number?
Yeah, I'm giving it a 7. I was really good. You know, it's short enough. It doesn't wear out its welcome. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, I wouldn't say it breaks any new ground.
No.
And it could have, you know, it doesn't quite pull on the heartstrings the way a Pixar movie does. But that being said, it's still really good.
And if this is indeed the end of this trilogy, which they purport it to be, it is a satisfying end. Matt, you look rather skeptical.
It'll
that
come
it is.
Back.
Why?
Because as I said in the theater, do we ever end any franchises ever?
There are more backpacks to sell.
Right. I don't think we end any franchise ever.
Isn't there a series somewhere?
There's a series.
Yeah.
There is a series.
There you go. So it lives on elsewhere. So our number is 7.4. It's at 94% on the tomato meter. So it is very good. And it's your only movie this weekend because it's the Oscars. So if your family wants to go out and see it on Saturday or Sunday day before the Oscars, you could do worse on a weekend in February. It is now that magical time of day when we talk about True Detective. We are now up to episode 7 of this third season.
Only one more.
The penultimate episode.
I was going to say penultimate, and you beat me to it. This one's called The Final Country. Ben, do you want to describe it, please?
No, because I was just, while you guys were reviewing How to Train Your Dragon, I was, you know, I saw it Sunday night, and so I was reading the Vulture recap to remind myself of some of the things I wanted to talk about. And like 6 times I thought, did I fall asleep?
Did you fall asleep?
No, I don't think so. But there are certain things in there that I flat out don't remember. And they're clearly very important. What I remember
like what?
Most, well, I enjoyed the fourth timeline, right? This
right.
little glimpse of
they sneak it in.
Wayne
oh, right.
and Rebecca oh, dropping yeah. her off at college.
Yes. Did you catch the reference to True Detective Season 1?
I did catch the reference to True Detective Season 1 with a picture of Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey in the paper. And,
so now we know there is a connection between them. Because
right, shared universe.
Shared universe.
Right, right.
The TDCU.
But there is a lot of stuff about the cop turned security agent at Hoyt, Harrison James.
TU, right? not cinematic.
That
TU.
I didn't get. Like, so what happened to that dude?
They had,
they tortured
we'd seen
him
that. Today. But we had seen that. There's some
the
reference well, to that earlier
that's
on
the
in
what
the season.
We done. We finally
right.
found out this
right,
thing,
right,
what
right.
we done.
No, I'm reading here, and I'm like, oh, so they tortured. He didn't survive. It says, I'm reading on Vulture.
No, they buried his body.
We saw them do that.
You fell asleep.
I fell asleep. Yeah,
that's
I mean, I saw the end.
Yeah. Yeah, they buried him out in the woods.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Wow. All right. Well,
we
or I've got far, far bigger problems.
And that's why Hoyt shows up at the end of the episode.
Just like Hayes.
To tell Hayes, like, I know what you did. Come out to the car. Let's talk about it.
But that conversation, as far as we know, kind of didn't go anywhere.
Well, I mean,
we
know that Hayes didn't die, but we don't know what else might have sprung from
right.
it. We don't know how it affected the investigation.
And we know Hoyt died recently, like from before 2015, I
right.
think. That
I think that's been mentioned.
And I was struck by that conversation that that Amelia had with the wife's best friend, right?
With the picture?
Yeah, because we had the picture where, and what I didn't get from that picture was that although they're wearing ghost costumes, that one of them is white and one of them is black.
Because you could see their hands from beneath the sheets.
Oh. Right.
I didn't notice that either. Right. But the woman who has the picture is really squirrely.
Very squirrely.
Yeah. About having Amelia take it. She's like, no, that's mine. I don't want you to take that. Right. So is she somehow involved in helping out with the abduction?
Well, she does eventually let her take it, though.
But why was she nervous? If she were just like a helpful citizen, wouldn't she say, sure, please take it?
No, I think that I think she knew the truth about...
She's protecting her friend.
Right, she's protecting her friend, after her friend has...
Lucy.
Lucy. She's protecting Lucy.
She refuses the book, even. Like, she doesn't want to think about all that
stuff.
So
she's protecting...
It suggests Lucy's, what we already think, Lucy's involvement.
Yeah, Lucy the cousin.
Right.
Significant in some way.
Right. She's protecting, and then she decides, no, you know what? I can't live with this anymore.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that we're going to find out that the guy who confronts Amelia at the book signing,
book reading,
he and what's the one that's dead? The one that got buried in the woods.
Oh, Harris.
Right.
They're the ones under the sheets that were procuring the girl.
Oh,
right. I think that's who was in the picture.
But maybe because it's Lucy, it was for less nefarious reasons. Like it was to give her to her, like as you, I think you suggested that it was give
like
her to her proper father. Or
it wasn't for sex.
Yeah, but obviously.
Or maybe it was.
Right,
obviously. I assume the worst. But Ben, what was funny was watching the beginning of this episode, you totally called it from what happens at the end of episode 6 to what you figured would happen at the beginning of episode 7 is that we see Tom dead.
Right.
You knew we were going to see him dead.
Yeah.
And clearly, like the second that we see him there with a gunshot to the head and a typed out note, clearly he didn't really kill himself. I mean, obviously not.
No, so part of what they did to me is not just to. So I still think part of what they did was, although it turns out they guess they didn't kill the cousin, but they did kill Harris.
Cousin Dan. Oh, Uncle Dan.
Uncle, whatever.
Uncle Dan,
Or maybe they do. Maybe we haven't found that out yet.
Because he's missing.
But I think the guilt they carry is not from Harris, because it seemed like Harris, although I should probably rewatch it, Harris earned his demise because he probably killed Tom. No, that they got Tom killed. That they knew better.
Here's the other thing.
And they sort of put Tom in that sort of what turned out to be a death spiral.
Mm-hmm. I think Hoyt tells Hayes he's got to finish cleaning up the mess, and Hayes has to go out and kill the cousin to clean up.
Uncle Dan,
so to clean things up.
Maybe. Here's a question I have.
And that's why he's suffering from these memory problems, because he's blocked all that stuff
out. Here's my question. The four of us are not detectives. We are not true detectives, but it was clear to all of us, I'm sure, the second that we saw the gunshot and the typed up note, that Scoot McNairy did not kill himself. Why do Hayes and Roland both take on face value this guy's suicide?
Well, I don't think Hayes does. He says, suddenly he's a typist writing a 3-line poem.
But Roland
I think, Roland, I think, feels guilty about having pushed him to that point. And then above them, obviously, people are very willing to paper over this whole thing. They did it with
the
junk man guy. Now they're going to do it to this guy. Like, as long as they can pin it on somebody, they don't care.
Right. I think that what we're seeing in that relationship start to break down is that Roland is making the decision that he can't fight those above him, and he's going to just let this be the end of it. And he, and that part of why he's so upset that Tom's been killed, because whatever Tom found got him killed, and it's kind of their fault. And he's like, you know what? I'm not going to get anyone else killed on this. If that's what they're capable of, then I'm just going to let this be the end of it, and let's just let it, for God's sake, end.
Right. I think that he says, you think I brought you back because I wanted to solve this case? I brought you back because I wanted to bring you back. I wanted to help you out. Like, and now I'm not going to do what you did in 1980 and cross these guys who were ready to say, to the DA who's ready to say, hey, great, good, this guy's exonerated, even though a lot of effort to exonerate a guy who did murder two cops. I don't know that exonerating him would be super important.
No, but it was because his kids were...
I understand, but I just mean he is still, like, from just a storytelling point of view, even if he was wrongly accused, he is not a sympathetic figure.
Right.
And would not be to law enforcement.
But I think they're doing it because they want to to drive home the fact that they're pinning it all on Tom now,
right?
And clearing Woodard means no, we got it wrong then because Tom is definitely the guy who did it.
I agree, and I think Roland is as Matt alluded to, is also ravaged by guilt for what he did to Tom, and rather than where Wayne is like, let's go solve this, Roland is like, or let's bury it and I'll try to get through tomorrow. Right.
Yeah. Roland is also pragmatic enough and ambitious enough that he wants to just like move on.
That's right. Yeah.
And Hayes can't do it.
I want to mention real quick the whole conversation that the documentary filmmaker has about the sort of the secret web of like powerful pedophiles and how they're able to make this kind of stuff go away reminded me a lot of a documentary that I saw at Slamdance a few years ago called Who Took Johnny that didn't get a lot of release but is now, you can rent it on Amazon. And it's about, it's a cold case about this paperboy in Iowa who disappeared, and sort of the deeper they get into it, the more they kind of think that he was a victim of a ring like this. And so
maybe that inspired the season or the whole series?
But I'm sure there's a lot of different stories that tie back to that sort of thing. But that's just a movie that I saw that really talks about it in detail. So if you're interested, it's a good documentary. It's worth checking out. Who Took Johnny?
Yes, it was very eventful, but there are still, you know, some details and some loose ends to tie up. So we have things to look forward to in the final episode here.
We find out that the wife never wrote the second book.
Right.
We also see that Hayes, like once he gets the information from the documentary filmmaker, he's like, oh, that's enough for today.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's now playing her. She was using him, and now he's using her. I think he was playing her
kind of all along.
He said as much that he was only doing it to find out what they knew.
And I wonder if I guess it was Matt who just, like, maybe some of his memory loss is less
faked.
Not so much faked, but trauma related.
Sure. I think so, and
not actual dementia related, so that sort of solving this, and as he pieces back and comes to terms with whatever it is he's done, whether it involved killing an innocent person or like just covering up the death of a non-innocent person.
He's forgotten why he's tried to forget something.
Right. That he may end up okay.
Yeah, like we don't know what the deal with the daughter is.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yeah, so that's the whole thing to find out. And then obviously, you know, the whole jumping back and forth in time thing, he apologizes to Stephen Dorff about making him feel guilty about Tom, which had happened, you know, 15 years earlier. But for him, it's all happening simultaneously.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
Many loose ends to tie up, but weirdly, the last episode of True Detective is going to air at the exact same time as the Oscars. So I guess they figure that folks are going to like watch it on demand afterward, or they're going to DVR it or whatever. Because
good news is I get to watch two episodes. It would appear
to find the subtle nuances.
All new to you.
Yeah. You get to sleep through two episodes.
All right. So thank you for sticking around with us this week, you guys. It's been so much fun. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BeFast All Day. Leave us positive reviews, whether you're listening, whether you're watching. Subscribe on YouTube. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. Thank you, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks. Bye.